You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Hey, Launch Street, do you have spice in your work? It could be the key to bringing ideas to life. Today, David Fraden stopped by Inside Launch Street to talk innovation. David has over 45 years of product management, product marketing management, senior management experience, and has been responsible for 75 plus products representing over $250 million in revenue. He knows what he's talking about. We dig into why we are often asking the wrong questions, which is why our innovation efforts fail from the start, how lack of process creates a culture of blame, this one blew me away, by the way, and why and how SPICE, S-P-I-C-E, moves innovation forward. Let's dig in. David, I'm so excited to connect with you today. Thanks for joining me here on Launch Street.
Glad to be here, Tamara.
So let's start, because I'm curious about this as I was going through your bio and all this great experience that you've had. Why do you think you've been so successful as a product innovator?
Well, I've had my shares of failures, but the ones that I've been successful on, I discovered as I was writing my books that if you focus on what the customer wants to do, why they want to do it, when they want to do it, where they want to do it, how they want to do it, and what's unsatisfactory with the current way that they're doing it, then you can easily develop your value proposition, and the customers that buy your products are delighted with those products. This is very much what Hewlett-Packard has done in the first 50 years that they were around, which caused them to grow 20% per year every year for 50 years. And it's pretty much what Dave Packard, I found in my studies, taught Steve Jobs after his three failures, the Apple III, which I took over later and tried to clean up, and the Macintosh, which also was a failure because four Macs were sold in January of 1985, 1 year after its introduction. And that led to him having to leave the company. And then his next computer, which I called his last, when I was an associate director of the market research of personal computers at DataQuest, was also a failure. And so while he was out in the dithering around with Pixar trying to get it going, he sat down with Dave Packard and he said, you got to get close to your customer and you've got to understand what your customer wants to do.
So let me back up into that a little bit because, you know, you're in Silicon Valley, which I think from the outside looking in, we actually have a lot of listeners there, but a lot are actually across the globe. And we look at that and we're like, oh, like, product innovation and marketing, it's so sexy, right? They get it. So I want to dig a little bit deeper, though, into what you mean when you say you have to know the why and what is unsatisfactory, because those are two things that I think if you're steeped in it, you totally get it. But if you're not quite there, it seems almost a little bit foreign.
Yeah, it is. There's a classic story, and we don't know if it's an urban fable or not, that if Henry Ford went out and asked somebody if they wanted a car, the people would respond, I don't want a car. I want a faster horse.
Right. Well, that's like if someone had taken an iPad, right, into a focus group and said, do you want this device that's, you know, no, you can't make phone calls on it and it's bigger, but no, you can't actually do all your computing. Do you want it? Who would have said yes to that?
Well, see, in both cases, it's the wrong question.
Yeah.
The question that Ford should have asked is, would you like to go from point A to point B faster? It's like Kodak, which used to be a multi-billion dollar company, is now worth a fraction of what it used to be. It defined itself for decades, for its entire life, up to its demisal or its demise as being in the still film and the moving film business. When in reality, they were in the business of helping people capture, store, find, retrieve, and display images. And if they had defined themselves in that business, then the inventors of the digital camera and digital film, a little company called Kodak, would be around today. But they felt that the film, the digital film, would cannibalize the chemical film business because they didn't define their business the way they should have, and they didn't ask the right questions in order to find the answers.
So how do we move from asking the wrong questions, which I, as you're talking about it, suspect most of us do, to asking the right questions to get to that meaningful place with our customers? So whether it's a product or service, I think I would argue it's the same for both. How do we get to those right questions so that we can get to that place where we're providing meaningful value?
Yes, a product is a tangible thing. A service is an intangible product. So they're exactly the same. They need to be treated the same. The way you get there is you start out like a social anthropologist, like a designer, like what Procter & Gamble has been doing almost their entire existence. The first thing you do is you go out and you observe what people are doing without getting into the scene. Just watch what they're doing. Then you interview them and ask them, why are you doing that? How do you do it now? I saw you do it this way. Are there any other ways that you do it? When do you do that? Where do you do that? And what's getting in your way? And then from that data, you then go out and do a survey so that you can extrapolate what you've learned in terms of what they do to the market as a whole. And then if you're lucky enough to have big data available, you can also use analytics to figure out what's going on.
So it sounds like, if I hear you right, that you almost remove the product or service out of the conversation to begin with when you want to innovate, when you want to move it forward, understand their perspective, and then bring that product or service back into it. Am I saying that right?
Yes, exactly. And going back to your iPad example, a friend of mine who is a product manager, in fact, he's the guy that composed the chime that you used to hear when the Mac booted up.
Oh, it's so iconic. Wow.
And he was teaching a class on product management over at Cisco when I was consulting over there. And we were both in the same organization at the time. And the iPad had just come out. And I had one on my desk that I was taking notes on. And there was one other product manager there, Steve Smith, who was also taking notes on his brand new iPad. And this guy says, I can't understand what the iPad is all about. It has no stylus.
What's the point?
What's the point? And what he completely missed is when Steve Jobs introduced the iPad, he was standing at a sort of like a desk, at a standing desk, talking about it. Then he picked up the iPad and he went over to an easy chair and he sat down and he laid it on his lap. This guy that professed to be a product manager completely missed that point, that what it was a means of mobile media consumption. You could read on it. You can watch videos on it. You can listen on it. You can surf the web on it. It was not a media creation device, and therefore a stylus was not important.
Mm. Well, you said it there, right? A mobile media. How did you say it again?
Mobile media consumption device.
Right. Like that changes everything. And now that makes perfect sense when you, and of course I'm Monday morning quarterbacking, right? So of course it's easy to look back.
Well, if people had, if they went out and observed people, they probably noticed them sitting on the floor or in a hall or on their couch with their laptop, breaking their legs and heating up. Watching a video. And so then it became obvious what the product should do.
Well, and I think what is interesting in that story that you're just sharing, David, is it's not about necessarily just changing people's behavior or improving what you already have. Sometimes the gap that you see in observation requires a whole new innovation or a whole new way to think about it.
Correct. And I think the term innovation is overused and greatly misunderstood. Innovation is simply helping people do what they want to do faster or cheaper or with style. And that's it. And that's when you then find the technology or a different way of organizing the activity, which is another technology, because technology is nothing more than the organization of knowledge for practical purposes that helps that person or that company do what they want to do faster, cheaper, with better quality, and or with style.
You know, I'm just going to take a pause for Launch Streeters out there listening and say that is a very important distinction with innovation. And I couldn't agree with you more. It is one of those words that everybody uses, but everybody has a different definition for. So you never know where people are coming from. But what you said about helping people do what they want to do. So if you're an intrapreneur or entrepreneur out there, I would encourage you to think about, are you helping people do what they want to do? Not what your product or service does today, but what your customer actually wants to do, which is a very big distinction. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I had a client out of India that had developed some kind of thing allegedly to track newspaper and TV advertising and see the results on it. But it was based on using text messages. This would be back around 2005, 2006. Well, at that time, and he wanted me to help him bring the product to market in the United States. Well, he couldn't tell me what the product is. He couldn't tell me what it does. And I still can't figure out what it was. But it used text messaging because in India, text messaging was free. But in the United States, a text message in those days cost 50 cents each. So nobody had any interest in using a product that cost them 50 cents every time they touch it. And that was because he failed when he put together his product market strategy before he went out and built the product. He failed to go out and observe and figure out what it is that advertisers in the United States actually do.
Yeah, what a great point, and it kind of ladders back or loops back to what you were saying about observing and understanding the actual behaviors and experiences around you. I want to dig a little bit into something kind of way in your past. And it's so funny. I think for our younger listeners, I'm a Gen Xer, so I remember all this, and I grew up with this, but for, the millennial and below, you'll be like, what are you talking about, Tamar and David? Like, what is this word hard disk that you speak of? But you were recruited by Apple to bring the first hard disk drive on a PC to market. And like I said, it sounds so outdated, but back then it was a big deal. And I'd love for you to share that experience and talk a little bit about what you learned from bringing something drastically new to market.
Well, most people couldn't understand it. They would say the floppy disk drive on the Apple II and the Apple III was perfectly okay. It was 143 kilobytes.
Wow. Like, think about that in today's kind of context.
Yeah. Why would they need this thing called the Apple Profile, which cost $3,500, maybe it was $3,600, and it held 5 megabytes, the equivalent to, I think it's like 40 floppy disks. Why would you want that much space? Well, it's because the right question wasn't being asked. If you had a secretary that had a large number of Word documents, word processing documents, they would have to sort their way through a whole bunch of floppy disks in order to find the one that they need to revise, whereas all of them could be stored at the same time on the hard drive. Likewise with large spreadsheets, likewise with databases, and most importantly with accounting. At those days, all the accounting was done either by hand or on mini computers or on mainframes through time sharing systems. Imagine being able to put a computer on your accountant's or your bookkeeper's desk, and all of it could be done right there. So with the right question asked, you can understand. On the other hand, the markets takes a while to assimilate a new concept. And that's called, I forget the exact term, it's the uptake on the new technology. And we have data and curves for things like TV, color TV, telephones, and so forth. But now we've got cell phones, in particular the iPhone, that has a massive uptake in just 1 year, such that they roll the product over in every year.
So let me ask you a question about the learning curve, because you had said, well, people didn't understand it. And I find that oftentimes with really out there innovation, things that are really they're going to change the customer behavior. And ultimately, in the long run, adoption will be huge. But you've got that initial resistance of, I don't understand this. I don't get it. How do you combat that? Because I'd say for a lot of innovators out there, waiting 5 years for people to get it or the marketplace to catch up is hard. We want to drive them forward. So what do we do?
Well, there's a couple of options. First, what you're talking about is what's called the customer journey, which starts with being at rest, do nothing. And then something happens that triggers them in order to start searching out their options and then selecting an option, buying the option, implementing that option, getting return on their investment for that option, and then make recommendations to others to buy that particular product. Well, a body at rest, Newton's law, body at rest tends to stay at rest. So you have to create, if that's where they're at in the customer journey for your product, you got to create some pain for them to go, aha, I've got a pain there that I need to satisfy. I have a thing I need to do. And that begins to move them on. The other thing you can do, and let me give you an example. I was credited by RCN magazine back in 2003 for having shipped the first advertisement on a cell phone. And then I tried to raise some money for my company, Maui Games / AdCell Media. And I was giving a presentation to the North Bay Angel Investors Club up in Marin County. And I explained what we were doing. And the whole concept was you're used to ads on your computer. Why not ads on your cell phone? And the guy that started Whole Earth magazine or the Whole Earth book series from Berkeley, he stood up and says, I don't want ads on my telephone or on my cell phone. Well, it's not his choice whether ads are going to be there or not. And I couldn't raise any money because I couldn't find any VCs in 2005 that understood media, advertising, and cell phones. But today, it's an over $15 billion a year industry. So I was early, and I've got lots of arrows in my back of being early on a lot of things. And the key thing I missed then was going out and observing advertisers to see if they would like to advertise on cell phones, which has additional advantages over advertising in the newspaper or on TV. I didn't do that. I also didn't go out and observe what cell phones were actually being used in the United States, because I believe Nokia, since they said they had the largest market share, I developed the ads for Nokia phones, only to find out later that Nokia was only selling two cell phones in the United States, where my advertising sales force was, yet I had a very large installed base of my cell phone games in Europe, where I didn't have any relationship with the advertisers. So I had a distribution disconnect in addition to being too early. But if I had waited and not had spent all of my capital, and then the iPhone came out and finally started driving smartphones forward, I would be doing pretty good in the cell phone advertising business today. In fact, I might even have gotten acquired by Apple.
We might be having a whole different conversation today, actually.
I wouldn't be talking to you.
That's right. That's right. You'd be like, I'm on my beach somewhere, my private island. First of all, I just want to say, David, kudos for sharing something that didn't work. I think there's so much value and lessons in there, and people are often too afraid to share that. And so I just want to say thank you for that. I think there's so much value in that, and I wish more people would do that. The question I have for you is, in that example, what question do you wish you had asked out of the gate?
Well, I think the key thing is putting together what is your product market strategy. The market is the place you go to. Marketing is taking the product to that place. The key thing, in addition to what I've already talked about in terms of understanding what the customer wants to do, is you then need to do the innovation, and that makes it really, really easy for you to write the value proposition. If I had a nickel for the number of times, as my friend Steve Johnson, who's taught about the only person in the world that's taught more product managers than I have, he says if he had a nickel for every time someone came to him with a brand new product and says, go find me some customers, he'd be a millionaire. So you sit down and you try to figure out what the value proposition is, when in reality, the product was built based upon that value proposition. Now, it may be the wrong one, but if you do the innovation, and then define the value proposition first, then you do your market research, then you do your competitive research, and now that gives you enough information to do your product positioning based upon what the customer finds value. Then you can do your market segmentation, your total available market, understand where in the customer journey your prospective customers are, then your sales, distribution, marketing, operations, support, and training plans, and then identifying what metrics you're going to use to determine success, and think through a little bit of your end-of-life strategy so you don't leave your loyal customers high and dry. All of those things should be done, as actually there's 32 elements to the product market strategy, which I go into detail on in the second volume of my books from Wiley, The Foundations for Product Success. And then you start development, and not until then. And if you have that done right, then your developers will understand exactly what the problem is, and they can operate in the solution space and build that insanely great product.
So how, let's dig into that. How do you figure out, I think if I'm hearing you right, what your customers do, and then translate that into the design, the product, the value proposition? Will you walk us through an example?
Well, you observe what they do, how they do it, when they do it, where they do it, and so forth. It's the same questions that a journalist learns, the who, what, when, where, why, and how. And then around that, you put together an interview questionnaire and sit down with 30 or 40 or 50 people and ask them questions about those dues. And you're also searching for how satisfied are they with getting a particular thing done now. Because your opportunity and your prioritization of features should be based upon a formula, which I talk about in my books and in my book on Amazon called Building Insanely Great Products. It's a formula between what they want to do and what their satisfaction is in terms of getting that thing done. And then that from that can then directly translate into a format for writing a value proposition. I've got a course on that called Do Innovation, Design, and Value Proposition, and I teach it at Cisco now and a few other companies, and it's also available online from Udemy. And then there's a template that I invented where you can use to write up your value proposition.
So we'll make sure to put all those links in the show notes too. So don't crash your car listening and going, I got to write those down. We'll make sure to put all those valuable resources from David in there as well. I'm curious from your perspective, when doing a value proposition for something that's more innovative, that you're bringing this kind of new to the world, do you have to think about it differently, or am I overcomplicating it? Is it simple as like, hey, figure out the why, figure out the do, and that stuff will come? It's not different because it's new.
Correct. Don't overcomplicate it. For example, word processing on a personal computer replaced dedicated word processors, which replaced electric typewriters, which replaced manual typewriters, which replaced scribes, which replaced ink, ballpoint ink and fountain pens, which replaced pencils, which replaced charcoal writing and on tablets. Back in even the days of the caveman, what they wanted to do is put their thoughts and ideas and concepts and pictures on something that someone else can see. And the innovation has been the technologies through all of those phases in the other direction, of course, that resulted in word processing on your computer and now on your iPad Pro.
I want to ask about this kind of leads me into a course that you have that piqued my attention. And that was, I think, as you say, how to build insanely great products. Will you give us, the listeners, a little bit of a couple tips of like, okay, if you're going to go do that, here are some things you really need to consider?
Yeah, you can sum up much of that in a mnemonic I put together called Spices, and hence the name of my company, Spice Cattle.
That's where that comes from. Now I get it.
The S is strategy. That's the product market strategy and those 32 elements that I talked about earlier. The P is process. You need a framework for your product development and management and the product life cycle, because you've got to climb the maturity curve in order to be successful. And one company I was consulting with did not have a process, and they asked me to design a product management lifecycle process for them because they had developed and shipped five products, and they were all failures, and everybody stood around and blamed each other. So failure to have a process develops a culture of blame, as that vice president of product management described to me. I is the information available so you can make the decisions at the time that you make the decisions. Many big companies that I've consulted with or worked for, who I will leave nameless, I would contact their market research department and say, I need information on this, that, and the other thing, which they were currently not subscribing to, even though they subscribe to 84 different market research services. Is it possible you could subscribe to those services so I can get that information so I can make some decisions about this multi-billion dollar product? And this was like in February, and that company's fiscal year ended in July. And the guy says, well, we don't have budget for that right now. We'll put it in the budget, and if it gets approved in July or August when the budgets are finally approved, then we could probably buy it next January.
Yeah.
You'll be out of business by
then.
No,
thank you. Yeah, no kidding.
So that's just an example of that. So that's the information. The C is the customer. That's what I was talking about earlier, clearly understanding what your customer wants to do. The E is the employees. Successful product management and successful products out of a company depend on 130 competencies that I've identified. And most organizations don't have many of those competencies. So the key thing there is to do exactly like the military does. Make sure your people are trained so that you have an array of people that have those 130 competencies at a basic level, at an intermediate level, and at an advanced level available to help you ship a successful product.
This is great. So I want to go back. You said something as we were talking about process that I think is important to dig into and that I really want to get your perspective on. You said lack of process creates a culture of blame. And I know that hinders success, innovation, performance. Tell me more about that, because I don't know that I've ever heard it framed in that way.
Well, for example, I talked about the product market strategy that should be done before the development. And I have, by the way, this framework on my website that people can go there and download. That needs to come first. And then you do the development. And then in parallel with the development, the product marketing manager writes the marketing strategy and the launch plan. Many companies just build a product and then they launch it and they sit back and hope they get orders, and they frequently don't, and the product fails or the company goes out of business. Well, because there's so many moving parts, 32 elements of the product market strategy, if one or more of them is missing before development starts, and obviously before they go to market, then they start blaming each other for the failure of the product. Well, you should have done this or you should have done that. I'll give you a classic example. The Apple III, which I took over in the last year of its life. First thing I did as the group product manager for the Apple III is I went downstairs into the basement and talked to a fellow by the name of Jeff Raikes, J-E-F Raikes, R-A-I, no, Jeff Raskin, excuse me. And Jeff was the architect of the Apple III. He was also the architect of the Macintosh before Steve forced him out of that product line. And I said, who did you build this product for? And he said, we built it for what today we call small and medium business and small and home office, the SOHO and the SMB markets. Well, those markets had not been defined by market researchers until about almost 10 years after Jeff had that market in mind for the personas of the people that he was building the product for. And when we were done talking, he turned to me and he says, you know, I've been here at Apple for 5 years. This was in 1982. He had been there since 1977. He said, you are the first person for marketing that has ever come to talk to me.
Wow. That's a missed opportunity.
Oh, yeah. And then I went, you know, back to be surrounded by all these MBAs who are really, really bright. Because Apple hired the cream of the crop and paid them 40% more than any other company in the valley, so that they knew that was important. And they said, well, wait a minute. There's the enterprise market, and we have no interest in that because Steve hates them. There's the home market, and then there's the education market. And they had no idea where in the market that the Apple III fit. So they all campaigned secretly behind the scenes to kill the product line. And the result of them killing the product line, and I made the final decision when I couldn't swim up upstream anymore against this immense opposition throughout the company, even having the product. The profits of the product turned out was employing about 1,000 to 15 of the best of the brightest of Silicon Valley. And I killed the product line in April of 1984. And 1,000 to 1,500 Apple employees, the best of the best, got laid off in January through July 1985. And that was before the Boston Consulting Group invented the concept called the cash cow. They had in the Apple III the cash cow, and they didn't know how to milk it because they didn't have the vision beyond the market segments they had defined previously.
So for those launch readers out there listening, you know, what I'm taking away from this story from David and this experience is make sure that you're out there collaborating with the people and, if nothing else, talking to the people up and downstream from what you do, because that's how you're going to get the whole picture, the whole vision. But it sounds like, David, from what you're saying, they just missed a critical element of knowledge that might have transformed the business.
Absolutely. It happened to me a couple times previously in my career. I was in the early 90s at a company called Digital FX, and they brought me in as the second product manager for a desktop video editing system called the VideoFX. And they targeted the product to computer owners, Macintosh owners that wanted to do desktop video. Well, first thing I did is I went out and I talked to 20 of our customers, and it turned out none of them were Macintosh people. In fact, they could barely find the on switch. They were video post-production people, and the value proposition is that the VideoFX product could cut the cost of a post-production system from $150,000 to about $75,000. But the company thought they were going to sell thousands of these things, and they invested $30 million in Hitachi to build $30 million worth of video FXs, and expecting to sell them thousands at a month. And at most, they were selling 20 a month because they didn't go out and talk to their customers.
Right. They were missing that key piece of information. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit on a question that's been gnawing at me lately, and I would love to get your right question or better question for this group. I was actually doing another podcast interview, and I was telling her, so for listeners, sorry, you're going to hear this twice, but it's so, I think it is so telling of the changing consumer behaviors we're dealing with. I went to the mall the other day, which was because I had to, not because I wanted to. I'm not a mall person anymore. Like many people, my behavior has changed. But what I found so fascinating was that, you know, 99% of the stores were crickets, right? Like fully employed with staff, but nobody shopping, except for the Apple store, which is really understood experience from day one, a Tesla store where you could, you know, get inside a Tesla, and a Peloton, you know, the spinning bikes store, which is clearly set up shop to create experiences. But I often wonder, what questions are mall owners asking themselves? Because the question of how do I get people back to the mall to shop is not working. So I wonder from your perspective, just to put you on the spot a little bit, what kind of question would you have them ask?
Well, let me give you a little background. When Steve invented the Apple Store, first thing he did was to go to Stanford Mall.
I've been there many times.
And he went in there with the guy that was helping him design the Apple Store into, I think it was the Eddie Bauer Store. And he noticed it had one entrance. Everyone had to come in and go out the same door, because Eddie Bauer figured out they wanted to control the entire customer experience. And of course, Wall Street went crazy in the early 2000s. Steve Jobs, he just wants to control everything. Well, he didn't want some pimply-faced salesperson selling his computers in Best Buy or Circuit City, which is now out of business.
Right.
He wanted to control the entire experience. That's the total customer experience. And you see that today in the Apple products. Everything from walking in the store and having an experience to buying the product and having an experience. You don't have to stand at a cash register. Everybody in the store's got a cash register on their iPhone. And walking out of the store, being trusted, and then going home and opening your Apple product, and it's like a jewel. It's like getting a ring or a bracelet or a watch or something. So I resell my used Macs and iPhones, and I save the boxes and put it back together just like it came. So whoever buys a used Apple product from me gets that same kind of experience all the way through. Oh, you got a problem with your computer and you bought AppleCare and you click on their Apple support website, enter your name and email address and phone number, click a button and Apple calls you. As opposed to Microsoft, I've just started using Microsoft Word on the Mac for 360 or 365, which is a substantial improvement. But back in the mid-2000s, I had two PCs on my desk because I was constantly rebooting. So if I said the Microsoft position is rebooting, and I say that I heard recently they've decided to change their tagline to something that reflects their company's positioning, to helping more people feel more stupid than any other company in the
world. Yes, agreed.
So it goes back to observing what people do. But I bet you those retail store managers, and especially those malls, think of themselves in the mall business or in the retail store business. And I'll give you another example. I sold a system for personalized recommendations to Sears, and it's on all the Sears websites. Or it's on the Sears website, the Kmart website. And it's the same kind of a thing that you get on Amazon or on Netflix. People who bought this, people who looked at this, that kind of stuff. And they were in a huge battle between their bricks and mortars people that thought the online stuff was going to cannibalize their sales. And the online people couldn't get the bricks and mortar people to become their allies as opposed to being their enemy. And guess what? Sears has been closing retail stores across the nation by the dozens now.
So is the question then they should be answering, you know, how do I create a valuable experience or a destination experience? I mean, where yes. should their – yeah, okay. Because it's clearly just a little bit of a bee in my bonnet about malls because I feel like they have an opportunity and they're missing it.
Well, it's worse than that. I used to be a whitewater rafting guide and I love Tevas. So after a few years, I finally wore it out and I wanted to get another set of Tevas. So I went to, what is it, Foot World or something like that. They'll carry them. And then we were going to eat over at the Stanford Mall and I went into Macy's, open top slippers like that that don't go through your big toe. And then we went to Nordstrom's. They didn't have any. We went to probably a half a dozen department stores there. None of them were carrying the shoe. That I was looking for. I'm going to go right back with my Prime account and I'll find the right Teva in about 2 minutes, click, and the thing just magically shows up without any additional cost because I'm on Amazon Prime at my doorstep. And this has been going on now for about 10 years. The shopping experience, and I'm not a shopper either, for those of us that are non-shoppers, is just horrible because you can't find what you're looking for.
Right, and quickly.
And quickly.
And if if they have it, you're lucky. You're lucky if they have it in your size, color, you know, fill in the
yes.
blank. And you know, for those out there listening, what David's talking about is so valuable for all of us, no matter what business we're in. I know I'm picking on malls, but the thing here is, what is the question that everybody in your category is asking? And then what is the question you should be asking based on the customer and what they want, which I think are oftentimes two very different things. And I don't know if you see this, David, but it feels like sometimes we get trapped in the questions of our categories and not in
yes.
the questions of our customers.
Yeah, and those market segmentation categories were invented by people like me because I used to be a market researcher and I used to invent them. And if I'm not talking to the customer, but we were interviewing about 150 PC manufacturers at the time, then that's just that I don't know what I'm talking about. And the market researchers don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's funny. I used to do a lot of work in food. And the biggest, I guess, brick wall I used to hit up was the way the grocery store categorizes the food. And that had nothing to do most of the times with how people actually shopped in the grocery stores. So I couldn't get a breakfast product into the breakfast aisle I couldn't get a product that maybe was breakfast but go with something else in a different aisle because it was breakfast and it had to be in the breakfast aisle next to the cereal. And that's not how customers shopped. It's such an interesting wall that we constantly hit.
Well, you have to understand human behavior. For example, if I go into a grocery store I've never been in before and I want to get a six-pack of beer, I ask the clerk where the diapers are.
Very funny. Well, David, I love it. You know, David, I feel like we could go on forever, but in the essence of time, where can people go to learn more about you, connect with you, et cetera?
They can go to my website, spicecatalyst.com, and look at the blog on product management and product marketing. They can connect with me on LinkedIn, and that's easy. It's, of course, www.linkedin.com/IN/my name, David Fradin, DavidFradin. And then if they are not a first or second level connection, they can request to connect with me through their network tab and use my email address, which is simple. It's Dave@SpiceCatalystOneWord.com.
Yeah, I love the name and I love the analogy. We just go through very quickly what everything stands for, the strategy, process.
Strategy, process, information, customers. E is...
the employees, right?
Yeah, the employees. And then the S, which I didn't talk about, is have the right systems and tools to get the job done.
Got it. Okay.
You don't take a hacksaw when you need a hammer.
Right. I thought we'd missed the S and I wasn't sure. So I wanted to make sure we covered all of them. All right, David, last question for you. What's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? Hobby, experience, passion?
Well, I got a whole bunch of interesting experience. I'm a certified flight instructor. I founded the University of Michigan Flyers, which has trained over 4,000 pilots in its 47 years of existence. I started a national student organization in support of an American supersonic transport, and then later in support of science and technology, when technology in the early 70s was being blamed for everybody's problems and the environmental problem. And then when I was 19, 20, 21, I was testifying before Congress, lobbying for the space shuttle, which I was successful on, and lobbying for alternative energy, for the kinds of things that we're beginning to do now, solar, wind, and so forth. And I was the youngest White House Fellows finalist in history. And then when the vice president asked me to go watch the Apollo 17th launch, Frank Sinatra was sitting behind me and he dropped his binoculars and he refused to let me get them.
Oh.
And then my big claim to fame is he tapped me on the shoulder because the rocket hadn't taken off and he asked me what time it is. I was wondering, couldn't he afford a watch? And then later I became the second environmental mediator in the world, and I successfully mediated two disputes, one for the Anheuser-Busch company and one on reserve mining, which was at the time was the largest environmental dispute in the history of the world, which resulted in the Duluth Herald calling me the Henry Kissinger of northern Minnesota, which still doesn't give me I still can't buy coffee at Starbucks. And then I handled a little bit of Dave Packard's PR and met him personally, including one night I was checking into the hotel just before a board meeting, probably about 1 a.m. in the morning, and opened the door and Dave was laying there sleeping. The front desk has screwed up and gave me the wrong room key. And then I was promoted to the same management level at Apple that Steve Jobs was at. But I think the most important thing is that I'm very proud of the fact that a fellow by the name of Larry David impersonates me on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I think that is the claim to fame right there. So, David, it sounds like you are always ahead of curve and someone for Launch Street to follow. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.